Welcome to Advanced Nuclear, the official podcast of UCAN Power, where leading experts, innovators, and policymakers explore the latest developments shaping the future of nuclear energy.
Welcome, everyone, to the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Howe, on behalf of the United Coalition for Advanced Nuclear Power. In this podcast, we're talking to leaders from industry, government, and academia about securing America's energy future by bringing new nuclear technologies to the civil power market and for bolstering our national security. We'll speak truth to power and cut through the hype to understand the benefits, the applications, and the challenges for advanced nuclear technologies here in America and around the world. It's an exciting time with growing support for nuclear power, and we're here to educate and inform. So what exactly is this thing called advanced nuclear? Well, we're lucky. We have a guest today who's an expert who will answer that question in detail. As a teaser, there's a wide range of technologies from micro to massive that can be used for an equally wide range of applications, and there's the fuel and manufacturing supply chains needed to support these new technologies. Our guest today has deep expertise in the world of advanced nuclear, and we're pleased to have him on the show. Mark Nickel is the Executive Director of New Nuclear at the Nuclear Energy Institute. He's highly educated, with undergraduate and advanced degrees in nuclear engineering, as well as a master's in business administration, and he's highly experienced, with over 20 years in the industry, working for some of the world's leading companies and America's leading trade association for nuclear power. I've had the pleasure of working with Mark for many years, can attest to his vast knowledge, and I'm honored to have him as a colleague. So, Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim. I really appreciate it and really look forward to doing this podcast with you today.
Great. So tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, what's your background? How did you get into the nuclear industry? What drew you to nuclear? And then what are your responsibilities at the Nuclear Energy Institute?
Yeah, so my interest goes way back, all the way to the high school years. I think it was 11th grade. I did a science project and picked nuclear space propulsion. And back then I had an interest in space, probably like most teenagers. And so learning about nuclear and how it could propel space, it was really interesting. So as I looked into going to universities, I still had a primary interest in space, but then also realized how exciting nuclear energy was for all of the things that it can do. I looked for schools that had both programs, so space and nuclear engineering, ended up going to Purdue. Started out actually pursuing space, but then as I thought through it, what really appealed to me about nuclear energy was not only that it was cutting edge technology, but that it had real practical benefits for day-to-day living and the fact that it was environmentally clean. Back then, this was in the early 90s, clean and carbon emissions were really novel things that not very many people, it hadn't made its way into the everyday lexicon. So to me back then, environmentally clean meant it wasn't releasing toxic gases, NOx, SOx, all those sorts of things. But, you know, come to find out, it was also free of carbon emissions too, which is really important today.
Got it. And so you're at NEI, Nuclear Energy Institute. It's America's, you know, leading trade association for nuclear power. Talk a little bit about NEI, you know, how does it support, especially when it comes to these advanced new technologies, how is NEI supporting that industry?
So we're doing a lot. Just a little bit of basic information about the Nuclear Energy Institute. We're an organization of about 350 members from 17 different countries. We primarily focus on U.S. policy, which includes export policy and engagement internationally. But largely focused on U.S. policy. And we operate in a couple of different areas. We operate certainly in legislative space and what Congress and the administration does in terms of passing legislation, establishing programs related to nuclear energy. But we also focus on the regulatory side of nuclear energy and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, making sure that we have smart, safe, efficient, and effective regulations. And so we focus in those areas. The way we operate is that we work with our members to understand what are the challenges, what are the needs, what positions do we want to come up with, and what things do we want to advocate for in order to help achieve our vision is a world powered by clean and reliable energy. And our mission is to make sure that nuclear energy is a key contributor to that. So that drives NEI and our engagement.
And because you represent the existing fleet here in the U.S., 94 large gigawatt scale reactors, basically, this advanced nuclear, it's kind of a new thing, right, to industry. When did this advanced nuclear industry really kind of start to come to fruition? Is that recent?
It's not recent. It will depend on what we decide the term advanced nuclear means. I'm sure we'll come to that discussion as we go through it forward. But we still consider advanced large light water reactors as advanced. So technically, it goes back to the nuclear power 2010 days. So that would be around 2010, and that would include the eventual deployment and operation of AP1000s at Vogtle 3 and 4. What most people think of as advanced is really focused on small modular reactors, non-light water reactors, micro reactors. Those are relatively newer, but truthfully, they go all the way back to about 2010 as well. Some of the light water SMR designs were starting to be developed. Back then, NuScale was around. There were other companies. MPower is one that many people might remember. That at that time, they decided that there wasn't a clear market signal for these technologies. So many of them went away. NuScale stayed with it. Later, as people started to realize that there was going to be a future market signal for these technologies, non-light water reactors came on as well. So to answer your question, since about 2010, we've been working on these things.
Okay, great. And there are some terminology issues here. We hear about different generations of reactors. And if I could try to see if I get this right, correct me if I'm wrong. So generation three are basically most of the large light water reactors, the gigawatt scale reactors around the country. And then the two most recent large ones are generation 3+. Those are the AP1000s because they have enhanced safety features. But it's the Gen 4 that a lot of people talk about and kind of consider to be kind of the mainstay of the small modular reactor fleet. And these are non-light water reactors. Is that correct?
Yeah, all of that's correct. I'd add to that there is technically a Gen 3+ small modular reactor, or SMR. That would be NuScale, GE, Holtec, and Westinghouse has variations of those in the United States. And so those definitions are accurate. There are also terms out there like small modular reactors, non-light water reactors, which generally match up with those terminologies. To get to the basics, because all of that can be complicated. And so I tend to not try to use those definitions because they are so technical and difficult to understand for most folks. What I focus on, and there's legislation out there that defines advanced nuclear, and it's any technology that has benefits above those plants that are already in operation since 2020. And those benefits could be in increased performance, increased flexibility, better enhanced economics, improved safety, or better fuel utilization and waste management. And so when you open up the definition there, I think it opens up the field for a lot more innovation than trying to silo them into very specific technical areas.
Oh, that's great. And so one of the things that people think about also, when, because you had mentioned small modular reactors, you'd also mentioned the micro reactors, you know, how small can some of these technologies be? And you already mentioned they go all the way up to the gigawatt scale, but I mean, how small at the other end can they be?
We know that there are some designs out there that are in the one to few megawatts in size. We know that there are some concepts out there, even for kilowatt size reactors that might have very specific uses. But I think we can talk about megawatts, but when we talk to the general public, they may not understand exactly what that means. So 1,000 megawatts can power a city of about 500,000 people. So if you take a 300 megawatt, that'd be a city of about 150,000 people. When you take a 1 megawatt, that'd be a very small town, about 500 people. And so you can see that there's a range of sizes based on population. Now, what's great about nuclear energy is that we provide more than just electricity, we provide heat. And so those same sizes can scale based on the size of industrial operations.
Okay, so you're reading my mind here because we're going to talk about that in just a second. But before we do, so you mentioned enhanced safety features. Could you talk just a little bit about what we're talking about? Because a lot of folks, when they think nuclear, unfortunately think about, Fukushima. They think about Chernobyl. I mean, what are we talking about when we say enhanced safety features?
So enhanced safety features are really the concept comes from learning from all of the past experience of designing, building, operating, and maintaining nuclear power plants. And as we learn that experience and we have better understanding of how the plants work, what could happen to them, how they would respond, we can actually design in features that can help to eliminate those potential vulnerabilities, reduce them, or mitigate them if they were about to happen. The most common approach that we've focused on is called inherent or passive safety features. And so what's important to know is passive doesn't mean you just sit there and watch, not caring what happens. But inherent and passive means we're going to use nature and natural processes rather than man-made and what we call active processes. And so, what does that mean? It's things like gravity, natural circulation. And for those that aren't aware, natural circulation means that if you have a fluid and you have a hot point and a cold point and you have a loop between them, the fluid will create its own circuit and move around and around to transfer heat from hot to cold. And so, there are other features like that. And what we found in this enhanced safety or using nature as our path to safety is that nature always works. Gravity always works. Natural circulation, the laws of physics don't change and they do work. Compared to when we do engineered features and active components, they may not work. They have a certain reliability associated with them. And so you have to factor them in. And so we have much more confidence and reliability on those enhanced safety features. And what's really important is that we dissect why we're doing this. So we're not developing enhanced safety features because the existing nuclear reactors are unsafe or inherently dangerous. In fact, what we know is nuclear energy today is one of the safest industries in the entire world. So while it is always good to enhance safety, we're not doing it because we need to in order to get these licensed or protect the public. We can do that today. So why do we do that? Well, we're doing it partly because it can be done as you start to shrink these reactors to smaller and smaller sizes. It is much more possible to use these natural features, gravity, natural circulation, and others. And what we find is as you do that, you can eliminate the need for a backup system because you have more reliability that nature works, so you have less need for backup systems and of backup systems, and that helps to reduce the cost as well. And so in all of this process, what we found is that safety and cost are not conflicting with each other or opposed. In fact, they're complementary. And as we enhance the safety of these reactors, we're actually enhancing the cost effectiveness as well.
That's terrific. And I saw a video with a sodium cooled reactor. So instead of using water like we use here in all our light water reactors, the coolant was sodium, which is a metal, and it has a much higher boiling point than water. And when they purposely tried to, kind of have an accident, they did all the things that would lead to a real serious incident. The coolant just absorbed all the heat, and then the reactor just shut itself down. It's pretty amazing how some of these non-water coolants can really, add to that safety case. Is that your experience?
That is true. That's a great example of one of these, and that would certainly be for sodium-cooled reactors. There are other examples. There's a fuel out there called TRISO, and I'll save everybody from the engineering name of it. But TRISO is different from conventional fuel. Conventional fuel is uranium with oxygen, called a which is a ceramic pellet, and then TRISO is uranium with carbon, which is a carbide type of component. And what we find with this TRISO fuel is that it's much more robust. You can actually design it, so it's providing containment at the molecular level or particle level, and it can sustain much, much higher temperatures so that the potential for melting is dramatically reduced, almost eliminated. And so that's another type of feature. There's many out there. Each design is focused on a different type of feature, but those are two of the more prevalent ones.
And you bring up a good point, as a lot of these, advanced technologies require advanced fuel forms, and we could talk about that more in a minute. But one thing I just want to point out is, have most of these, I'm doing air quotes right now, new technologies, they've all been demonstrated pretty much in at the national labs. Is that pretty much the case?
It is the case, actually. All of the technologies have been demonstrated at the fundamental operational safety perspective at the national laboratories. Many of them have been demonstrated to be viable commercially. So high temperature gas is an example where that's been operated commercially in many countries. There are other technologies that maybe have a little bit more room to do design and engineering, but that's not proving that these technologically can operate and be safe. It's more about improving the design and designing the specific components that are needed in that plant.
Got it. So, when we think of nuclear power, we're thinking about electricity, but you just mentioned that there's a lot of other use cases for some of these new technologies that are coming online. Could you kind of just walk us through kind of the broad range of different applications where we can use a nuclear reactor to do things aside from electricity production?
Yeah, the applications of nuclear energy are really endless. So just to start from the energy products, because it's the energy products that are going to be used by applications. Nuclear's energy products are obviously electricity, because we've done that for decades now safely and effectively. But it's more than that, because nuclear energy creates first heat. And so that heat can be used directly. That heat can be converted into electricity. That heat can be converted into hydrogen. And so those three components or those three energy products are the ones that could be used by any application anywhere. And so when we start to look at the applications, we can divide them into different areas. I won't talk about electricity because we covered that a lot. But when you start to look at what could be converted from today's energy products to electricity, we start to identify, well, vehicles, anything where you might use batteries, those could be drawn off the electric grid. And so it's one of the reasons why we're expecting to see increased in electricity demand. When we look beyond that, then we start to get into industrial process, heat processes, and we get into transportation. So looking at the industrial, there's a lot of processes that use heat, and some use different temperatures of heat, some very high, some much lower. In terms of the high heats, it's metal refining and reforming. In terms of the smaller heats, there's paper processing, there's chemicals, and things like that. We can see the interest in those areas from projects that are being pursued. Dow Industries is looking at X-energy's plant in Texas, specifically for their processes. When we look at transportation, you could use, as I mentioned, you could convert to electricity, you could use hydrogen for those, but there's some that Can't really do that. And I'm thinking about marine shipping. So the ocean cargo ships can't really use those as products, but they are very interested in nuclear reactors to power those ships. And the Navy has done that for a long time, so we know it can be done. And so then that'll take me to the last point, which is remote applications. Not everything is in highly industrialized areas. Some are very far away from the populations or other areas of infrastructure. And so those could be for villages, like in the Arctic or islands. They could be in they could be for mining operations or other things. And within all of this is the defense applications and a Department of Defense interest in a lot of those areas for their own particular needs. So the use cases and applications for nuclear energy are endless.
Well, let me hit you up on a couple of those are also in the news every now and then. One is desalination, where water is kind of like becoming the big commodity in a lot of parts of the American West, for example, in Texas and elsewhere, where they just don't have a lot of clean, fresh water. It sounds like a small modular reactor or a micro reactor could be used to power desalinization plants, which I know are pretty energy intensive. Is that the case?
Yeah, that is the case. Yes. So desalination is an example of another application, and because there's limitations to water, and water is scarce in a lot of parts of the world, and so desalinating it, but also cleaning the water, so you can power reverse osmosis machines, and so if you don't have, it may not be salinated, but it also may not be clean, and you could clean it in that regard, which then brings up the question of, well, don't these nuclear power plants use a lot of water to keep cool? And so I want to address that because we can locate these in areas where there's no local body of water to draw from. Today's operating reactors, they do require a local body of water as what we call the ultimate heat sink to be able to reject heat to. What we're finding with advanced technologies is that we can design them, or they can be designed so that they can be dry cooled. They don't need a local body of water to draw on to be able to provide that ultimate heat sink. And so yes, these new technologies can be deployed in those more arid areas.
So that's a real boon for nuclear and for society writ large, because water is the essence of life. Speaking of life, though, we also hear about medical isotope production using some of these different types of advanced reactors. What's the deal there?
Yeah, there's a lot of interest in producing medical isotope with the advanced reactors. Some might do it by recycling or separating out those useful radioisotopes from used fuel. There's many companies that are looking at doing that. Others may produce it directly in their reactors, and that's how we get most of our radioisotopes today, is that they're produced in operating reactors. So that's a huge effort, and there's a couple of important things in terms of our quality of life that you mentioned. One is more access to more abundant and less expensive radioisotopes. That's going to help everybody with those current isotopes that are being used by the medical field. But the other is the discovery of additional radioisotopes that could help to cure cancers or treat other diseases.
So using nuclear to solve medical issues, that's pretty amazing. But you also mentioned one thing that's my absolute favorite. So trivia question, what's Jim's absolute favorite? And that's space power and propulsion using nuclear. Can you talk a little bit about that? What are the advantages? Why would we want to use nuclear reactors to power spacecraft?
Yeah, the reason is twofold. One is weight, and the other is sustainability. So the current fuels for space are liquid, chemical in base, and it has two limitations. One is that it's a finite source, and so once you use it up, you run out of it. The other is that it's not very energy dense, and so you need a lot of it to provide a little bit of power. Those tend to be nuclear's advantage. First, we're energy dense, so you can have a very small amount of material that can provide a lot of power, and it can provide it almost indefinitely for a very long time. So you get that sustainment and you get the lower weight, which helps in all aspects of space explorations, whether it be propulsion to go places like Mars, whether it be to put bases on the moon or Mars, or to do other things. What's really interesting, and maybe most people don't understand, is that nuclear is already being used in space to do many of those things. It's not a fission machine, like fission is the type of use that we have in our electricity generators, but it's a radiothermal generator, and it basically uses the decay of isotopes to produce heat and energy. That provides less energy, and so it's more used for satellites and things like that. But NASA and DoD are very interested in pursuing the use of fission in space.
Yeah, it's fascinating when you look at the history going all the way back to the 1950s with the Project Rover, where they actually built and demonstrated 22 different reactors for potential use as rocket engines for spacecraft. That program died 18 years later after it was started in 1973. It was ended, and we've had two subsequent major programs, and now we've got a fourth one actually that is ongoing with NASA and DoD. It's DRACO, the demonstration rocket for Agile Cislunar Operations. They hope to put a small nuclear thermal propulsion unit on orbit here by, I think they're talking 2027, 2028 timeframe. It would be the first time any nation has ever used nuclear thermal propulsion. I know the Russians had a couple of dozen spy satellites that were nuclear powered, but they weren't propelled. They were just using that for electricity generation. So it's a brave new world, and I think it brings a lot of capabilities to both the civil space exploration as well as for DoD for whatever their uses are needed up in space. Yeah. So you, Mark, you had mentioned also DoD applications, and there's a couple of ways to think of it. One is for fixed sites. You've got a base somewhere, like here in the United States, where you want a power, you want a resilient, defense infrastructure for these key, defense installations, and also is mobile. If you have a disaster somewhere and you need power on scene, or if you've got a contingency operation in a different part of the world and you need to bring power to a large forward operating base, can you talk us through those uses, and also what is the U.S. military currently, pursuing in that sense?
So I'll start with where DoD began in their interest in pursuit of advanced nuclear technologies. And I first became aware in the 2016, 2017 timeframe, and it was following some DoD reports that really looked at the energy infrastructure to be able to achieve DoD's mission. And they recognized that without reliable, resilient energy, that they weren't going to be able to continue to sustain their missions, no matter where it is. Everything runs on energy. And they, back in the time, they identified that there's really two types of energy in DoD. There's installation energy and there's operational energy. What that means in terms of nuclear technologies is that they need fixed plants, and they need plants that can be moved from a site to a site in between operations every once in a while. And so we call them fixed reactors, and we call or them mobile reactors. And there's really sort of two key needs that differentiate those. So when we talk about the fixed reactors, those would be installations that would be continental United States, that would be at defense bases and other installations. Their critical need has become to defend the homeland, or the homeland as a fortress. So what that means, and you can get all this publicly in the defense strategy, is that with the current evolution today, our adversaries have an ability to attack us at home. Whether that's cyber attacks, whether it's EMP pulses or other things. And so our energy infrastructure at our domestic bases is now a potential vulnerability, or it's a vector, a threat vector. And so the answer to that is to be able to make our energy supply for national critical missions at defense installations resilient. And there's two key strategies. One is to be able to separate from the grid so that the grid isn't a vector for attack and it can be its own isolated island. And then the second is to harden it and make it robust against EMPs. And microreactors help DoD do that. They're one of the few technologies that are resilient, reliable, operate when you need it around the clock. And one of the key features there is that the fuel will operate or will be available for years and years and years. You're not susceptible to fuel disruptions. Take some of those considerations and put them into the operational environment, and these would be locations outside the United States. Now, they could be forward bases. There's a lot of thinking in that area, but they could also be, I'll just call them centers of infrastructure overseas. Could be U.S. bases, but it could be also beacheheads that are established. And those areas have critical missions in terms of radars or defense, missile defense, things like that. And there's four key things in the area of operational energy that are needed and what nuclear energy can help with. The first is that currently a lot of resources go to transporting energy to those front lines and those near front lines. And those are things like ships, airplanes, land vehicles, a lot of people and cost. And so if you have a microreactor that has fuel for years and years, you can repurpose those to warfighting missions. The second area is the need for endurance, indefinite endurance in those OCONUS locations. And so let's just take an example of the South Pacific, which is if China were ever to be our in conflict with us, one of the strategies they might use is to blockade the island and prevent energy from getting there. And on today's current liquid fuels, they would only have a matter of a few days or maybe weeks that they could endure that type of blockade. If you have a microreactor, they could endure it indefinitely because you have years and years worth of fuel on there, and they can basically wait it out until the cavalry comes to help them. And so that's what in infinite endurance means. The third area is enhancing the capabilities of the warfighters, and there's a lot of ways to do that. One is just look at the Army. They have a major effort underway to electrify the Army. Well, if the Army is electrified, they need to get that electricity from somewhere, so they need to have access to reliable, resilient power like nuclear reactors. The second is that a lot of our advanced weaponry is based on high needs for energy as well as quality of energy. And so you could look at directed energy weapons, and certainly today's energy supplies reach certain levels of capabilities. But my understanding is that nuclear energy can provide much higher levels of energy and much better quality of energy, so that the effectiveness of those advanced weapons becomes even greater. And then the fourth is humanitarian and disaster relief. And what most people don't realize is that there are a lot of those responses that our military has. And so being able to bring a microreactor with them, the military could help reestablish the electricity, the energy supply. That's going to help all of the operations for humanitarian relief, including hospitals and food distribution and other things. So those are the key things. Now, to get to the last part, sorry, it's a long answer, but to get to the last part, what is DoD doing about this? Well, they have programs that they're launching. They've done Project Pele, which is looking at the mobile side for several years. It's getting very close to being able to load fuel and go into operations at Idaho National Laboratory. We're expecting that to occur over the next year or so. And then on the installation side, Air Force, Army, and Navy, they all have programs to explore the use of microreactors at domestic installations.
Excellent. Thanks very much. And my understanding is that Project Pele is going really quite well. So that's testimony to the folks running that program. So let's shift over, though, because the big thing that we all hear about is artificial intelligence, data centers. There recently was a protest in Northern Virginia against some new data centers that were being proposed. And instead of signs that read, you know, don't tear up our historic battlefields or don't, you know, create pollution, it was things like, you're stealing our electricity. So the public is kind of aware of the fact that the data centers do require a lot of electrons to operate. It has to be very reliable electricity as well. And it looks like we're coming to a crunch time where the lack of growth of the energy infrastructure in the U.S. could kind of, you know, limit the amount of data centers that we can build, which would be a terrible thing. We need to win the AI revolution and be the world's leader in that. So where does nuclear fit in when it comes to powering data centers and artificial intelligence?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Starting from the bottom line, which is it's an AI race around the world, and AI is important to national security. And so one, we need more AI from a national security standpoint. There is a market driver and commercial and need for that's driving more AI. The power demands are humongous. A lot of these are reaching the need for 1,000 megawatts. We covered how much power that is. So, you know, when you talk about signs, you're stealing our power, bringing in a data center at 1,000 megawatts, that's the amount of 500,000 people's homes. And so that is a lot of electricity. And so we do need to build more electricity to meet this growing demand from data centers and AI. And everybody recognizes that. What we're seeing from the tech industry that's looking to build these facilities is that vital to their business case and sustainability of operations is reliable, resilient power. And when they have done the calculations and come to the conclusions that nuclear is a great answer for those needs. And so there already are announcements of deals between technology companies, AI data center companies, and advanced reactor developers. Last I checked, there's an announcement almost every day about these agreements. Last I checked, those totaled about 26 gigawatts of electricity. And so that is the demand for new nuclear. The growing demand as we go forward with that. There's a couple of things to keep in mind to make sure that we're realistic about this. The first is that a lot of the power needs are urgent and very near term, and to build new nuclear power plants takes time. And so there's two points or two responses to that. One is that we need to begin quickly on developing and deploying new nuclear technologies. The second is we need to figure out what is that interim solution until the first plants come online in the early 2030s. And that comes from our existing plants, obviously keeping them operating longer, but we can also uprate and power many of them. We can restart some of the early premature decommissioned plants. And so that's going to add gigawatts of power in the interim until these new plants come online. The last thought in that, it then becomes, well, what is it going to take to deploy these new nuclear technologies? And there's a lot of thoughts out there. DOE has a liftoff report. NEI worked with another industry association called the Electric Power Research Institute and developed an advanced reactor roadmap that lays out what it's going to take to enable these to be deployed. And there's seven key enablers in there.
Well, it's a lot to think about. So let's open the aperture a little bit, though. Aside from AI, all the other things we've talked about, what are the biggest challenges facing the advanced reactor community as people try to bring these new or upgraded technologies to market?
Yeah, it really came out of the advanced reactor roadmap I just mentioned, and it's in those seven key enablers. And I'll go through the seven key enablers. There's actually two major categories to them. So the first major category is accelerating and ensuring the early mover success. And one element is in the very first movers. That's the first of a kind plants, and they're challenged by higher cost of new technology into the market, which isn't unique. All new technologies are usually higher cost and have that challenge. The second is in the uncertainty about what the actual cost will be at the end of the day. And again, that's not unique. That's common for a lot of large projects. But the problem is that it's preventing the first plants from moving forward. And so it does need to be addressed. And I can come back later and talk about what's happening there. The second item within that first category of early movers is what we call fast followers, because what we hear from potential owners is that they're interested in being second. And what they mean by that is they'll start their second project as soon as the first one's built and operating, so they have certainty on costs and schedule. The challenge with that is that because of the time cycle for deploying new nuclear, they would have waited so long that they wouldn't be able to effectively capture lessons from the first plant to drive down cost, and they would effectively be their own first of a kind. So we have to find ways to enable them to follow closer behind so that they can benefit from risk reduction, but also benefit from transfer of lessons learned. The second major category is getting to scale. And so this would be after we've demonstrated the early movers, when we're ready to expand and deploy tens and tens and tens of reactors every year. And those things break down into regulatory bandwidth, siting availability, engagement with communities, supply chain capacity, and workforce. And so those are the major challenges, and we are working on many of them.
Yeah, that's a lot to think about. And NEI, what are like the one or two top things that NEI is pursuing to help the advanced reactor community? Are they the things you just mentioned, or are there any specific programs or policies?
Yeah, the one that we're focused on most, we're addressing all of them, but the one we're focused on most, and most people are focused on primarily, is enabling the first movers and the fast followers, those to be able to move forward. And that's addressing the higher cost and higher cost uncertainty for those new technologies. Because without that, it's sort of like the first domino. Without that, none of the other dominoes can get cleared away. And so we're working with federal policymakers, we're working with state policymakers, we're working with the industry, we're working with those AI data center off-takers. Everybody has a role to play in solving this early mover challenge. From the industry side, we're focusing on how do we minimize and mitigate the risks of early mover projects. We're learning from past projects, both those that went well, those that didn't go well. How can we do better and how can we minimize risk going forward and helping to put that in the hands of the people that are going to implement these projects? Now, companies are willing to take on some risk, but the risk total, the financial risk total is too much for a company to bear. And so we're looking at the federal government and the state government to implement policy support in those areas. The federal government, which has been very supportive over the years and has many programs, we're working with them to look at how they can provide protection of cost overruns and to help mitigate the impacts, so as a way of protecting ratepayers. At the state government, we're looking at what the states can do to help accelerate projects through funding of pre-project activities, as well as addressing other limitations in the states and markets. And then finally, the off-takers are working in this, and they're willing to step forward and take on a higher portion of the burden of increased costs because it's so important to them as a way of them helping to protect ratepayers. And so everybody's stepping to the table. Everything is moving in the right direction. We need to not walk away from this conversation and think other people have this. It's going to be solved. We all need to be involved and keep pushing this forward because we're at a very critical inflection point of success in this area.
Well, thanks for bringing up the topic of financing, because everyone knows that nuclear, does not come cheap. The modularity that's being brought into the industry is going to drive down some costs. And of course, as you said, as you get to these nth of a kind costs, you'll have much better efficiencies in your supply chains and production. But what is the trend right now? I know, for example, like in the fusion industry, and fusion, is really the ultimate solution, but it's still many years away. A lot of money has flowed into fusion, but where are we on fission? Is the private sector accelerating the amount of money it's putting into these fission-based projects, or is it going to be up to the government to handle the load?
Yeah, there is a lot of private capital flowing into, and has been for a long time, flowing into these advanced fission machines. There's billions and billions of dollars being put directly into the designs themselves. A lot of this comes from venture capital. There is million, hundreds and hundreds of millions and billions of dollars being put into projects, specifically to be able to move them forward. If we just look at TVA, they've approved 100, I think it was over $300 million to move forward on their TVA project. That's just sort of the beginning. And the supply chain is starting to invest and prepare so that they can meet the demands as well. So yes, capital is flowing into this area. And I mentioned a lot of those agreements with tech companies. They're actually making some financial investments to be able to help designs and projects move forward.
So instead of you're stealing our power, it's you're paying for our power. That's a big difference. That's a great thing. So with that, you've provided us a ton of just great information here, Mark. What's the one thing you'd like the audience to walk away with? What one concept you'd like to people not forget about this conversation?
Yeah, I think the one thing is maybe two parts. One is that as we all recognize how important it is for more nuclear energy today, that we take away a sense that it is possible, and there are many great things that are happening to make it a reality, but to also be realistic and to realize that it's not a foregone conclusion. If we take our foot off the accelerator, if we sort of rest on the successes we have today, this may not come to fruition. It's going to take more work. It's going to take more solutions. It's going to take more support and innovative ideas to help make this a reality. Nuclear is difficult, but the benefits of nuclear are tremendous. A lot of those benefits aren't reflected in the cost of power. They're sort of less financially tangible benefits, and the country needs more nuclear power. So let's all work together to make it happen.
Terrific. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time and insights. You gave our audience a lot to think about, and it was really great speaking with you. I'd like to also thank our producer, the undisputed champion of podcasts, Miss Kimberly, and to all the team at UCAN Power for their support. Please check us out on social media and at www.ucanpower.org. Until next time, thank you for tuning in to the Advanced Nuclear Podcast.